This week in Retronauts, this one goes out to the ones we love, even though they're not super. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts episode whatever the hell. I've lost count. I don't know when this is going up. But you're listening to it now, and that's what's important. And I am Jeremy Parrish, disorganized as ever, and here to keep things on track and within the guidelines we have.
Hi, I'm Bob Mackey, and I love shell creepers. That's what they're called, right?
That is what they're called.
They're the prototypes for Koopas.
Mm. How about you over there in the corner, the opposite, like kitty corner from me?
Oh, I don't know what that means. I'm Ray Barnhold.
I think that's a Midwestern term.
Is that linguistic? Note it is. Yeah. You can either say kitty corner or catty corner, but don't say either one.
Too late.
God.
The seal has been broken.
I don't like people knowing I'm from the Midwest. It's very embarrassing. I'm just going to have a cold glass of pop.
Hey, LCD Super Mario lover, Henry Gilbert. Hi.
And yes, we are here to talk more about Mario. You're sick of Mario. We're sick of – no, it's not true. We all love Mario games. And this is actually a follow-on from our most recent Mario episode. Last time we recorded an episode about Super Mario Brothers 2. And it was supposed to be about an episode about Super Mario Brothers 2's, but we didn't have time to tackle the second one. And rather than just cram it in and give it short shrift, I felt like we should talk about Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan, The Lost Levels. And, you know, since that might be a tough conversation to have an entire episode about, I thought, well, why don't we, bring in some of the other sort of odds and ends that kind of exist on the periphery of Super Mario Brothers and Super Mario Brothers 2 as we know them in America. So this has become an episode that I'm calling Super Mario Oddities. It's a very funny joke. But this will be a lot of the games leading up to basically Super Mario Brothers 2, The Lost Levels, that don't fall under the banner of Super Mario Brothers. And we've called in people who know and love Mario games. And I wanted Ray here to be here. I wanted Ray to be here specifically because I know he is willing to go to the mats for the Japanese version of Super Mario Brothers 2.
That's right.
Would you consider yourself a fan?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like that game does not have a good reputation, and I'm actually not really that big on it. So I wanted to have someone here to balance my negativity out.
I'm totally ready to yell and scream about it.
All right, do it.
Let's get Ray fired up.
So without further ado, let's yell and scream. Going to start with Mario before he was super. We're going to talk about Mario Brothers, which we've never – I don't know that we've ever really discussed that on Retronauts. Mm. And it's that's kind of weird because it's – you know, it's, as much as we talk about Nintendo games and Mario games, this is kind of a linchpin title. It's very like a keystone almost.
Yeah.
And a lot of things come out of it. You know, Super Mario Brothers definitely was the more impactful game, but there could be no Super Mario Brothers without Mario Brothers. And I'm actually, you know, this is a game that I liked as a kid and then decided wasn't that good. And now I've come back around on it and I really like it again.
Sorry, I thought you were done with your sentence. But this has been my wallpaper for the past 3 years on my phone. The Mario Brothers art for the arcade cabinet is some of my favorite art of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I love it so much.
I love their floppy hats and dumpy bodies.
And the little plus sign teeth.
Yeah. Very Fleischer meets anime. It's great. I love this game so much. And I remember this game. I'd played things like Atari 2600 and Pac-Man and stuff, but I just remember being drawn to this game as a child just because of just all the characters and stuff like that on the screen.
Yeah, so this game came out in June of 1983, I want to say. Very, very – like right around the same time that Nintendo launched the family computer in Japan. But they were still, you know, applying the arcade trade at that point. And I think this is one of the games that they developed internally, which is why you see it on things like Arcade Archives, whereas you don't see Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., Skyskipper, that sort of thing, because those were done externally. And I think there's a lot of rights issues with those. But Mario Brothers was their own work, their own creation, top to bottom. And it was a pretty big game. It represented a big change for Mario the character, and it represented kind of the establishment of Nintendo's very sort of, I don't know, like their favorite approach to multiplayer gaming, I would say, which is cooperative but also competitive. Like there's room to be helpful and friendly and support the other person, but also room to be a total dick and screw over the other person.
Yeah, I especially like how they have – it's like a shared resource thing, that PAL block. It's just this thing that you could both use, but you kind of have to plan to use it together, and it's like a trust exercise almost. And then if you want to just be a dick, like, well, I'm just going to use them all once, bow, 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 ha, fuck you.
Well, that's not even the biggest way to be a jerk in this game. Like the fact is Mario and Luigi, his newly introduced brother, are vulnerable to the same – mechanics that the enemies are vulnerable to, and you can punch the ground under the other player to screw them up, or you know when they're going in to kick an upside down enemy, you can punch underneath the enemy to flip it right side up. So, like you can really be a jerk and totally screw over your friend or rival or who sibling whatever if you want to, but that's not the ideal way to play. However, it does exist.
There. Doesn't accomplish much. No,
no.
In the
except they, making people mad.
Right.
When they put this game into Mario 3 as a mini game, you could steal cards or trade cards from your from the second player, but no one ever really tinkered with that much. But it was you could play Mario Brothers in Mario 3.
That was the first time I played Mario Brothers because my local arcade didn't have it. My local pizza place had DK and DK Jr., but not Mario Brothers. And so only when I tried out the versus mode in Mario Brothers 3 did I get to finally experience it. Then I discovered it at some arcade afterwards.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask when you guys discovered the game. So now I know with Henry, it was in Super Mario Brothers 3. What about you, Ray?
I probably rented it for NES. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I think I also saw – I hadn't seen the arcade version before, so I think I only saw that at like Circus in Reno.
Okay.
We were on a family trip once.
Were you there
on the set of The Wizard?
No. I mean it felt like it because there was like this basement arcade with a bunch of the retro Nintendo games at the time. Hmm. I was just like, oh, shit. I haven't seen any of these before. Don't let me go.
Reno's very impressive to children. It's less so when you're an adult.
One part of it.
one basement.
Yeah.
What about you, Bob?
I think I could be conflating this with Popeye or maybe Kangaroo in terms of where it existed, but it might have been in a lobby of like a Big Lots or a Hills department store in Ohio. Mm-hmm. But I remember always being drawn to the art and the characters of the game for sure.
Actually, yeah, my pizza place, they did have Popeye. That was – I think now I look back on it. In Mazio's Pizza, that was my – in Arkansas, that was my
–
Mazio. I remember Mazio's.
That was my favorite of the machines they had there was Popeye because I knew who Popeye was.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
A giant ape is fun, but here's Popeye and Bluto, characters I've heard of. And I don't know why Popeye is punching bottles all the time, but it looks fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and because I'm an old person, I played this game in the arcades when it was brand new. It was, you know – pretty widely circulated in 1983, 84. So it was all over the place and I played it a lot and sometimes I got to play it with other people, but mostly I just played it on my own because, you know, it was always at like roller rinks or whatever and other kids wanted to skate and I was like, physical activity, I don't know, but
no,
I could play video
you.
Games.
No, thank you.
Yeah. So so I definitely have fond memories of playing this back in the day. But of course, you know, once Super Mario Brothers came out, then I was like, Mario Brothers, that's stupid and old. Who cares about that? That's just one screen. There's no boss. You don't have really cool stuff to do and power-ups, et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of got thrown by the wayside. But Nintendo still loved it.
Yeah.
And kept revisiting it over and over again.
It's an important part of Mario continuity history too in that, well, obviously, you know, the first appearance of Luigi, but also it's when they decided he's a plumber, not a carpenter.
Right.
And from then on, he kind of would be as much as Nintendo – I feel like they don't want him to be a plumber anymore. like canon, they're like, well, no, he's Mario. Yeah, it's fun. He's not.
But they can't get rid of the pipes.
So yeah, the
there's
pipes
this whole pipe thing that's stuck there.
Like all plumbers, he climbs through pipes, like the human body-sized pipes.
The plumber is some sort of American invention in terms of Mario's lore.
They leaned into it a lot more because of that. And like, you know, you don't see him holding a plunger or a wrench in anything but like American cartoons. So.
Yeah. And, you know, Mario had a lot of odd jobs in the early days. And we'll talk about some of those later. But like there was a Game & Watch game where he joined the army. But you don't see Nintendo like Mario the Soldier or Mario the Demolitions guy. For some reason, they really seized on
the owner of a cement factory.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well, he's in the mob, but so plumbing is sort of like Mario's like Sonic's chili dogs almost, where it's this iconic thing that no game actually references.
Sure,
right. Though in Sonic Generation, he eats a big chili dog.
Yeah, like, at his birthday party. Recently done that.
They've even accepted like fine chili dogs, whatever. But yeah, this was the first year of Luigi in 1983.
That's right.
though he technically, I think. By a couple months, the Game & Watch version of this came out first. So I think that
Right?
Well, this is old research I did for an article like 5 years ago, so I could be wrong. But as I recall, the dates on at least a Wikipedia page, which have to be true.
Oh, well, yeah, if it's on Wikipedia.
Yeah, they pegged the Game & Watch hitting the Japanese market before Mario Brothers Arcade did, but...
Interesting. Well, this game did...
Let's bring that to the talk page, Henry.
Mario Brothers did make its way home very quickly. You know, this was, like I said, the arcade game debuted right around the same time as the family computer. And the Famicom version of this debuted in like September. So that was about 3 months, which is a really quick turnaround time. And of course, the home version was not as impressive looking as the arcade version. There was like some severe flicker on character sprites, and the characters didn't look as nice, and you know they didn't have the little sort of glowing vanishing effect on coins when you picked them up, and there was just a little less color depth. But still, it was a very accurate version of the game. It captured all the content, all the enemies, all the play mechanics. The physics felt right, and so I kind of feel like this was sort of an important work for Nintendo to say like, hey, we are really serious about the home market, because here was this brand new arcade game and you could have the version that they created to play at home just a few months later, you know, if you were a kid in Japan.
But it was one of the last Nintendo games they really started licensing out big time to the US consoles, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was definitely on... It was on Coleco, was it?
It was on Atari.
Yeah, 2600.
And 5200.
Yeah.
I think the Atari version is where we get the amazing commercial that references Car 64.
It's coming up, the plumbing for Luigi's in a bind. Giant turtles out to get him, creepy crabs are right behind. Fighter flies, jeepers, shites, they're all coming out the pipes.
Mario, where are you?
It's Atari Mario Brothers with Mario from Donkey Kong.
That's where it really dug into people's brains, the plumbing thing. That ad. I didn't see that ad when it was new because I was like one or two. But I did buy old comic books that were published in 1983 or 4 that had the back page ad was a comic book version of Mario, Where Are You, the song.
Yep. Yeah.
The novelization.
And it's – that's right. The see the hit comic based on the commercial. It's interesting though because the American commercial for the home version of Mario Brothers for some competing system is kind of the first instance we see of Luigi characterized as a little bit of a nebbish, where he's like, Mario, where are you? Not quite Charles Martinet there, but I mean that's like the characterization they give him is a little bit helpless without his brother. And that's really sort of stuck, is like Luigi's always in Mario's shadow.
But it's closer to the Lou Albano type voice though.
Right.
As well, it's more.
They're Italian, don't you know?
Yes,
it's funny on the art for the arcade game. Luigi is the more aggressive one. He's like shaking his fist at monsters while Mario's just sort of like looking in the pipe quizzically.
Yeah, he takes more of the lead there. I wonder if they hadn't done that ad, if we would think of Luigi as the wuss of the group,
Agro Luigi,
because otherwise, like that wasn't even his characterization in the Super Show so much as the guy who was afraid. He was just like – him and Mario barely had characters on the Super Show. I guess The only characteristic was like Mario was hungrier than Luigi because he was drawn fatter. Like that was the one difference.
Well, in this game, they're completely identical. Mm-hmm. They have no differences whatsoever. They are the same sprite with different colors.
Yeah. Oh, also, wasn't is this an old wives' tale about the game, but that they Miyamoto wanted them to be able to jump on the turtles and the enemies, but they couldn't. So, like technologically wise, so they had to hit. That's how they invented the hitting them and kicking them.
I don't
them
know. Thing. I feel like hitting a static object in a level and making it ripple is more technically challenging than coming up with the collision detection for someone for one sprite to jump on the other. I could be wrong, but
I had always heard. Well, this again is just a wise tale.
But I mean, how different could that be from the routine that caused fruit to fall onto to birds or trap jaws or whatever in Donkey Kong Jr.? Like that idea was already there.
I
feel like the ripple effect on the floor that's more complex, more challenging.
I'm sure something predates this, but I think Super Mario Brothers unlocked this idea for all of humans that like, oh yeah, jumping on things, that's a way to kill things. And every game before that's like, no, you cannot touch anything.
You're dead. Yeah. You touched it.
Just shoot it. Shoot it.
Yeah, I can't think of games before Mario where you could actually collide with enemies and come out ahead unless you were powered up or whatever.
Yeah, and Pac-Land or Smurf, like you were dead if you touched anything. Mm-hmm.
And Mappy had to use microwaves.
Yeah.
Burger times, you had to drop burgers.
Yep. But Mario was his own burger. So yeah, the play mechanic here, you don't jump on turtles. There are no Goombas. The turtles are called shell creepers. There are fighter flies, which are little hopping flies.
They're fun.
Shell creeper crabs. You can't jump on anything. Instead, what you do is the enemies come out of pipes and make their way down to the bottom of the screen and basically go into a loop. And to clear out the stage, which is the goal of each level of all enemies, you punch the floor underneath that enemy, and it'll flip the enemy upside down. And there's a little bit of complexity here. Like if you punch directly under the enemy will flip straight up in the air and land on its back. But if you punch adjacent to the enemy,
oh, yeah,
then it'll hit it at an angle and cause it to flip. Fly at a 45 degree angle as it flips over. And you can use that to your advantage by hitting the floor between two enemies and causing both of them to flip over. And then once they've flipped over, then they're helpless for like 5 seconds. So you run up and kick them off the side of the stage. But you have to be careful because they will flip over the right way and after a few seconds, and then they become more aggressive and will come after you. Some enemies have to be flipped over twice or hit underneath twice. And yeah, so it becomes more complex and it becomes faster and there's more variation.
And I think we neglected those ice demons.
Slip ice.
Yeah.
I was about to mention those.
And you have to kill those before they infect the entire platforms.
Right. Yeah, so they'll come out and they come out of the pipes at the top and slide along the ground. And whenever they come to the center of a platform, the first clear platform that they come to the center of, they'll take anchor and start to spread ice along the entire surface of the platform. But if you punch them from beneath before the platform is completely iced over, you'll prevent that from happening.
Ice physics in a game of 1983's vintage is pretty complex. I'm actually surprised there were no ice levels in Super Mario Brothers or ice effects.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think I mentioned this in the Super Mario Brothers episode, but people would call certain levels the ice level because they were kind of like a white or light gray palette. But I never read them as ice because you don't slip on them. In Mario Brothers, you had ice and you slipped on it.
I think it was placebo effect. They just thought they were slipping.
Well, slip ice guy, it's one of my favorite attack items in Smash Brothers as well. Like, they're great. You just throw them, you froze the dude, and they go through the stage just the same way. And I don't think this was inspiration for it, but this kind of single screen area where you fight in, it does remind me of Smash Brothers as well in a similar vein.
That was pretty much arcade games at the time.
Yes.
And really, this has direct precedent in Joust, which was a 1982 game by John Newcomer for Williams. And that was a single screen arena with multi-tiered platforms. And two players could compete at once, cooperate and compete. So, and it even had kind of the same effect where you would affect an enemy and then you would have to follow up with an attack to get rid of it. So I feel like this game must have been somewhat inspired by Joust.
There's no way,
Nintendo is kind of its own little bubble, but at the time, I find it hard to imagine that they were completely oblivious to the existence of other games. And, you know, Joust was even one of the games that Satoru Iwata and HAL converted to NES to Famicom as part of Nintendo's pitch to Atari, like, please license our console for sale in America and distribute it for us. And that was happening. You know, they were making that pitch in 83, 84 or so. So they had to have been aware of Joust. And that's fine. Like this, you know, they made a much more direct Joust clone a couple of years later in the form of Balloon Fight. But I feel like, you know, they probably saw that style of game and were like, oh, that's a, you know, I like the dynamic there. That's cool. Let's create our own take on it. And they came up with something that was wholly unique. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
It's interesting to see what they didn't keep for the super version of this game, the super sequel, in that only the Koopa survived and you never saw crabs again. You never saw flies again. Maybe there's kind of crabs in Yoshi's Island, but they're very different.
There's crabs in there's Cloglip in Super
True,
Mario.
True, that's like
USA.
That's the dad of these things.
Yes.
But I also noticed that I think they something that always got to me, and even though I love this game, it's like I always feel so bad for the turtles when you knock them on their back, so they're just looking around like helpless. So I feel like turning them into shells when you stomp on them in Super Mario Bros. Was like it was a game design thing, but also a way to make it seem less cruel.
Right. But that's one of the places where the game's personality comes through. You miss it in the NES version, but in the arcade version, once a turtle is ready to right itself, you get kind of like a visual signal because it hops out of its shell and it's wearing like, you know, an A-neck and boxer shorts.
Oh, that's where this comes from?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it flips over its shell and climbs back in.
I'm so used to the NES version that I forgot about that detail.
Yeah. Well, the NES version lost a lot of that because it was a very early game, so ROM space on it was extremely strict. It was probably like 16K or something. But they did revisit the game for Famicom Disk System, and then that version came out in Europe in like 1992 or 93 or something. It was way later called Mario Brothers Returns. And that was one of the games that they took a lot of their old Famicom, like early day software, and sort of upgraded it for Famicom Disk System, sometimes bringing in versus version arcade upgrades into the remakes. So this one was basically just like they restored the graphics to look better, less flicker, more animation, bigger sprites, and also advertisements for a ramen topping and for Super Mario Brothers 3. So I guess that was 1988 that they would have done that version. And for whatever reason, we never got that version in the U.S., but they did release it extremely late in Europe. So it was like the arcade classic series.
Nintendo of Europe.
So we kind of got the short end of the stick on that one.
Nintendo of Europe is weird. They release things whenever they feel like, especially then, they were just kind of fumbling in the dark in a Sega-controlled continent. So they didn't really know what they were supposed to be doing.
The important thing about what Mario Brothers did not include is that it did not include Donkey Kong at all. Mm. There is no Donkey Kong in this game. And so this is, you know, kind of the point at which Mario spun out from Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong 3 happened around the same time and did not have Mario. It had Stanley the Bugman who, you know, I've thought about this a lot. Like whatever happened to Stanley the Bugman? And then I discovered Donkey Kong 3 Daigyakushai or Daigyakushu, the Hudson-developed sequel to Donkey Kong 3, which basically has this unfolding narrative through the background art where you're like fighting Donkey Kong 3 style through like a cornfield and then a highway and then like there's a UFO and then you're like fighting Donkey Kong in the UFO. So I think Stanley the Bugman was actually abducted by aliens and taken away from Earth, and that's why we've never seen him.
Went back to his own planet.
I something like that. So the Smash Brothers assist trophy is like a memorial to Stanley, MIA.
I know in the background of a stage in Tropical Freeze you see his bug zapper there, but no Stanley.
Hmm.
It said they walked through the old they walk through a stage, and in the background is the setup for the first screen of DK3.
Are all the level layouts the same in Super Mario Bros.? I mean Mario Brothers in terms of level layouts? I want to say yes.
As far as I've played, which is like – I've probably made it to like level 12 or so. It's always the same.
Was that a new idea to have multiple levels but the layouts to all be the same?
I mean, no. That was usually how games worked. Yeah. Like Pac-Man, it's the same maze the entire time. Okay. Ms. Pac-Man is amazing because the maze changes.
Yeah, I'm conflating those in my head.
Donkey Kong was amazing because the levels changed with each stage that you cleared. So this was actually kind of a reversion in that sense. But it was probably more focused on just taking that same framework and increasing the speed. This is the game that introduced coins to the Mario toolbox, which – is something that they've only recently begun to escape the tyranny of.
It was nice in Odyssey to finally not have to care about coins.
Yeah. But oh, I died and lost 10 coins. Whatever. What am I going to do?
But they look shiny and they're so cool in Mario Brothers, especially when you get to the bonus stage. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, it's only coins? There's no enemies? I got to get every one of these things. Ah.
And that's where the competitive element really comes in, because you want to get more coins than the other player, but you also want to clear out the coins entirely.
It's a similar rush to getting a star in Super Mario Brothers. It's just like, I've only got so much time. I got to get all I can. Nothing's in my way but me.
And yeah, finally this, like I mentioned, you punch the ceiling above you. And so people, for a long time think that Super Mario Brothers is about Mario smashing bricks with his skull, which is not the case. It's just not as clear here that you're in those games that you're punching, whereas it's more distinct in the sprites here.
In my brain, I always read in Super Mario Brothers like it was – no, he's going hooray as he smashes it with his head and just lifting his fist up like, yeah, I'm doing a smash. Like,
yeah, that's Occam's razor failing badly. this game, like I said, Nintendo kept it in circulation for a long time. It was remade for Game Boy Advance and showed up in any game on Game Boy Advance that had Mario in the title.
Even
Superstar Saga.
That was inexplicable to me. And I mean, it makes sense in any way. I mean, it doesn't make sense that it's in the other games, but I mean, it's a nice addition. But to put it in an RPG is just like, just add it. We have this.
Right. And then there was also Mario Clash, which I have never played because it's for Virtual Boy. So I missed out on it. But it's pretty much Mario Brothers.
I had a good time with it. I never owned a Virtual Boy.
Can you describe how it plays?
They could make it now. Like, it would work just the same, but it is just – the pipe takes you into foreground and background. And so you're killing all these pests in the world, but you also warp between the foreground and background. And sometimes you can – Mario now can kick things. He has his kick ability and hold ability to throw things at it. And it was a clever idea that, they played around with foreground and background stuff, like even in that Wario – I think the first Wario Land had that too. So it was cool, but
well,
even
in Wrecking Crew, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, but it was just sad that it just kills your eyes like every other game. Like, so it – and I guess too, it wasn't enough to sell me on the system, because I was used to a Mario game not being that – thin. Like, it didn't have a big world. It didn't have that many tricks to it. It was just a remake of Mario Brothers in the truest sense. I was hoping for a time, I was like, they could just recolor this and make it work on the 3DS.
I was thinking,
could be 3DS.
They could have done it with every Virtual Boy game, but it's a shame.
They haven't yet, you mean.
I want to play that.
They've abandoned it.
There's a Wario game I haven't played yet, and it's supposedly very good. That Wario game for
it is the killer app.
Boy, yeah. Back when Wario mattered.
Yeah. But yeah, Clash was fun. I think it was the last time they had any super nostalgia for it enough to make a new Mario Brothers game.
But the arcade version did come out recently on Nintendo Switch from Hamster, and as with all the arcade archives, a very nice conversion. So if you've ever wanted to play Mario Brothers and not the bowdlerized NES version, that is the way to do it. It's like $8. So it's a pretty good price, in my opinion.
$8.
Eight human dollars.
I probably spent $30 on Mario Brothers in my lifetime. So
I mean, yeah, like I could easily pump $8 worth of quarters into Mario Brothers over the course of, you know, a few conventions.
There's another one on this list that I'd pay the $8 for more, so.
Okay.
Unlike Pac-Man, I can get pretty far in Mario Brothers on one quarter, like at least four or five stages. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's extremely fair for a game of this era.
I agree. Yeah, so I mentioned Donkey Kong 3 Dai Gyakushu earlier, one of those games developed by Hudson as a sequel to a Nintendo release for Japanese personal computers. And we have a few of those to talk about, including a direct follow-up to Mario Brothers called Punchball Mario Brothers, which is Mario Brothers, but with this one weird added mechanic. Ray, do you want to talk about this one? Because I feel like this is very much in your wheelhouse.
Is it?
Just like
I haven't actually
knowledge of esoteric Hudson games.
Well, I mean, you pretty much explained it as much as it needs to be, I think. The only thing about this game is that instead of, well, adding to it, they just add a projectile weapon called a punch ball, which it doesn't – which you might think might bounce around like it does in Super Mario Land, but it doesn't
kind
of.
That was my
fault.
It just
kind of flops in front of Mario, and it's just used as a weapon to kind of hit the enemy.
It's like a bocce ball or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's interesting because it's a persistent element. It doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Like you use it, and it's permanently there in the stage. And Mario has one, and if you play two-player, Luigi has one. And you pick it up and kick it, and it like flies forward a little ways and flips over an enemy. So it's almost a little bit like you know, the mechanic that would be introduced with Super Mario Brothers 3, where you could pick up turtle shells. Which is kind of weird. Like now that I think about it, like this sort of, hey, here's a crazy new element that's totally surprising in Super Mario Brothers 3, but Hudson kind of did it in this weird spinoff in 1984 that you know, only people who owned 8801 or X1 or whatever ever played and experienced.
I'm watching footage of this right now, and instead of the enemies flying off the screen when you kick them, they explode.
That's a pretty good addition.
I think a lot of it, yeah, I think they were just trying to like work within limitations because obviously those computers were more limited as far as game capabilities as the Famicom was. So they just tried to tweak things a bit to make it work.
Yeah, so I haven't played this game myself, not owning an 8801 or X1.
No? What?
Yeah, it's funny.
Come on. All this Patreon money.
Can you flip over enemies in this one by punching underneath them, or is the mechanic strictly the ball? Do you know?
I don't really remember.
Yeah,
I think I
tried to find information on that. I watched a bunch of videos, and all I ever see is people throwing the ball. And I tried reading about it, and
which is why I say what I do because they probably you know, there's limited animation, limited graphics in general. So they just had things where like, oh, the enemies just explode. We can't like have them fly off or anything. That would be too much, too expensive on the old processor.
Right.
Not just be a sad corpse flopping off something. I mean, so many people made bad ports of Mario Brothers that I kind of impressed they just like added an extra mechanic to it to explain the limitations that it couldn't be as good as an arcade version, so they just added a new concept to it. Though I can't see a Nintendo being cool with that with most developers, but Hudson, they're usually pretty cool with Hudson.
I want to talk about that when we get to Super Mario Brothers Special, but I have some thoughts on why we see these games.
Yeah, I'm really curious about that.
But we'll talk about that later. First, we need to talk about Mario's other job, Demolition Man, with Wrecking Crew. Wrecking Crew is kind of an interesting game in a lot of ways because it's the last Mario outing before Super Mario Brothers. So that was the game that really defined, like, this is Mario. This is his universe. This is everything that's around him and everything that he's about. And it was not made by Shigeru Miyamoto and his EAD4 team. It was made by R&D4. It was made by Yoshio Sakamoto and Nintendo R&D1. So it's a little bit weird and has its own kind of thing that it does. I was writing about it this morning, it occurred to me that it does feel kind of like an attempt to go back to some of the mechanics of the original Donkey Kong, because it's very heavily based around ladders instead of jumping. And Mario has a hammer. But instead of using the hammer as necessarily a weapon to crush things, it's a permanent tool he uses. And you use it in sort of like a puzzle game, and you're trying to clear out 100 different levels of this terrible construction site of destructible objects. And to clear a stage, you have to clear all the destructible objects on the stage while avoiding enemies and your rival, who is not Luigi. It is the dread Foreman Spike.
He's got a beard. He's early Wario.
He is, yes.
I mean, he's Bluto. It's the closest to actual Bluto he's been bothered with his entire career.
Yes, definitely. It's Mario's dark shadow who looks pretty much like
self.
Mario. Yes, exactly. It's his persona.
Wow. He hasn't accepted him yet and to truly defeat him.
That's what the door is for.
I like to think this game takes place after Donkey Kong in sort of like a post-apocalyptic sort of thing, where Mario's civilization decides that they don't want any more guerrilla attacks, so they just knock down all infrastructure to keep that, make sure that never happens again.
That's great. Yeah. I love it.
The nuke and pave approach.
Yeah.
So the way this game works is there are 100 stages, and in each stage, like I said, you have to destroy all the destructible objects. So these construction sites are basically arranged in platforms that scroll up one vertical screen. So it's two screens high for pretty much every stage. And there are objects. Some of them take like one hit to smash. Some of them take four or five hits. And then there are indestructible objects that you can't destroy, so you don't have to worry about them. And then there are these doors, and Mario can't do anything himself with the doors. If you hit a door, there's a door there. It's open, okay. But the doors will close after a few seconds. If you happen to hit a door while the monsters that roam the stage, which are like wrenches and eggplants and stuff, of course it's an eggplant. Of course, it's an R&D1 game, so of course it's an eggplant. They will walk into the door, and they go to the backside of the stage. And so there's like the foreground where Mario exists, and then the background, which is where Foreman Spike lurks, and also the enemies will go back there. If you send an enemy into the back, then it's basically out of play. It'll still walk around and you can see it in the background, but it can't hurt Mario. So it's an unusual mechanic. And if you hit a door and open it while an enemy is in the background, it'll walk through the door back into the foreground. Foreman Spike never comes into the foreground that I can remember. He's always lurking in the background and doesn't go through doors. And what he does is basically just tries to dick over Mario. Like, he is the – I almost feel like this was meant to be a two-player game, and it was just like too complicated for them to handle. So he became like an AI-controlled second player because he is basically like what you experience as the worst-case scenario when playing Mario Brothers with someone else. It's like someone who hates you does everything within his power to screw you over, and that's Foreman Spike. That's what he does. He will hit you from the background, and it will knock Mario off his current platform and drop him to the bottom, which doesn't hurt you, but it can keep you from being able to finish the stage. Like, if you don't have a way to get back up, like with ladders or whatever, some ladders are destructible, then you have no choice but to reset the level and start over.
Ray has his own headcanon, but I have mine, and it is that Mario is a scab, and the workers are on strike, and Spike is a union thug hired to rough him up.
I see.
That's my headcanon, but I think it could work with Ray's as well.
I'm actually surprised that you put the villain in the role of the union here. I thought you were very pro-union.
I didn't make the game.
Okay.
I'm against this.
He's saying that Nintendo is very anti-union and thus casting the union as the villain.
That's true.
I can see that. I think it's very strange that in 85 they were, at least in the Game & Watch sphere, they were calling things Mario's blank. And so it's just odd that this is not Mario's Mario's Wrecking Crew. It's just Wrecking Crew. I mean, Mario's right there on the cover. You know he's in this. So it's just weird they took away that branding possibility from them, like from a sell point issue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very, I mean, Mario looks off to me in this. Just his head is so weird.
I think he's got like a hard hat on, but he's off model here. Everything about this game is off model. It's a little odd.
There is a sequel that's sort of like a Puyo Puyo style game, which
is
kind of fun.
I have tried playing that, and I do not understand the mechanics of it.
I got into it one weird summer where I was playing a lot of
weird
ROMs.
Bomber. Wrecking Crew 98, is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, 98, yep. That's right. But I think like Nintendo could dust off this idea and make a new puzzle game out of it. I feel like there's a lot of unexplored territory with this idea.
Yeah, I think the some of the puzzle mechanics need to be refined a little bit. There are a lot of situations in which a game, a level just becomes unwinnable. And I feel like if you have to quit by like sacrificing a life, that's not really an ideal puzzle game.
No, I think you press select or something and it resets.
Yeah. But you lose a life if you do that.
Yeah, that's what I don't like. That's, I feel like a cardinal sin of puzzle games.
Yeah, I feel like that one element, if they could figure out how to make that work better, it could be good.
That's why I couldn't get into that Klonoa Game Boy Advance game.
Oh, I do like those a lot though. Sorry. could you explain what Wrecking Crew 98 to me? Because I've tried to play it like two or three times and I just bounce off it. I'm like, I don't know what's going on here.
It's been a long time since I played it. Ray, wasn't it part of that Nintendo Power, not the magazine, but the marketing campaign? What was this?
It was a Satellaview game, wasn't it?
Not originally.
I don't think so, no. It was like one of those convenience store things they would burn onto a disc for you.
So technically it was a cart release.
Yeah.
That's why it's 98.
But man, Foreman Spike is a lot hotter in the 98 game.
Oh, yeah.
Though he has a Wario nose, which again tells you it's R&D.
I've never heard anyone express thirst for Foreman Spike before.
Well, you're not in my corners in the end. Sorry.
Yeah, though. Wrecking Crew 98 is like where the levels of the levels of the game, they just sort of are turnable on a reel, sort of, and then but they're all colored panels and doors instead of the usual.
It's sort of like Yoshi's Cookie meets Puyo Puyo, and then you can move the rows, and you can also like break stuff in order to have things drop. It's complex, but I feel like once you play a few rounds and kind of understand it, you can get into it. I enjoyed it, and again, I feel like they could trot this out and make something else out of it.
I think it's that I would blame this not coming back all that much to. The same reason, like any Mario game that wasn't under Miyamoto's purview doesn't get too returned to all that much. I think aesthetically, Wrecking Crew stuff appeared in Super Mario Maker just because it really fit with the construction aspect. But
we didn't get the little wrench dudes or whatever.
Yeah, apparently
the eggplant.
There is a sprite of Foreman Spike in Mario Maker with a mystery mushroom. I just found that out. But other than that, Construction Mario on the cover of Mario Maker is – that guy could star in a new Wrecking Crew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is definitely like the Wrecking Crew 98.
They should have called
Mario.
Super Mario Maker Making Crew.
And of course, there's a Wrecking Crew thing in micro games and WarioWare at some point. But that's just because R&D1 references every game they ever made, even pitching machines in micro games.
Mm-hmm. So the other notable thing about Wrecking Crew is that it was one of three programmable series NES games, none of which really lived up to their potential in the U.S. because they were designed to take advantage of the Famicom data recorder, a cassette tape recorder that would plug into the Famicom basic keyboard and allow you to save programs. But you could also save Excitebike tracks, Mock Rider tracks, and Wrecking Crew courses with the data recorder in Japan. I have tried using that setup with NES games, and it just does not seem to work.
It was so cruel of them to include the save option on those carts Americans.
I think they intended to bring over some sort of solution for that, and then once it actually came over, they were like, "Eh." So yeah, if you try to load a stage in Wrecking Crew, you have to reset your system because it just hangs.
I think saving does the same thing.
Speak.
Yeah.
I think save it'll like. It sends data, and then once it's done, it'll be like, okay, you're done. But if you load, then it's waiting to hear cassette data, and it just hangs forever. It's very sad. All right, so here we are at the main course, the main event, Super Mario Bros. 2, The Lost Levels, released in June 1986, a mere 9 months after Super Mario Bros. That's a very quick turnaround. The original Super Mario Bros. Was famously designed as the ultimate expression of what you could do with cartridge-based technology. Like they really just made an incredibly efficient video game. Like some of the tricks that they used to get that much content, 32 stages and, you know, a dozen different enemies and all kinds of, you know, hidden bonuses, et cetera, different environments. To get that onto a cart, they used all kinds of compression tricks and like, you know, clouds as bushes and that sort of thing. Or bushes as clouds. I don't know. Whatever. They didn't have those limits with Super Mario Bros. 2 The Lost Levels. So it's a more visually diverse game and also a game that exists to basically like take you by the shoulder and then repeatedly punch you in the face.
Yeah.
It's the first
Super Mario Bros. For super players.
Mm-hmm. It's the first Massocore games that we call these games where it's like
– yeah. I think this style of game, the style of sequel, was actually pretty common, especially in arcades at the time. You would get like, you know, Space Invaders or Zevius or whatever that was just – it's the same game, but it's way harder now.
I think it came from back then when there were fewer games around. They could count on that everyone had played Super Mario Brothers to death, that they all needed an extra challenge. You could release a game that would finally kick you in the butt after that.
Well, and also this game came out for Famicom Disk System, which means it had the ability to save your progress. So they could afford to like – you know, punch you in the face repeatedly because you didn't have to go back as far when you lost.
I'm curious. Do you know how often it would save as after every world maybe? Or I'm just curious how much you'd have to replay.
I haven't played that much of this on disk system. I've mostly played on virtual console. So Ray, is that something you could answer?
I don't know definitively. I don't remember.
So sorry, people expecting expert opinions here. We don't have them. But yeah, this is like a super, super difficult game. Sometimes it's difficult in a way where I'm like, I don't know. It feels a little cruel.
A lot of it is poison mushroom at the very start of the game. And
no, I think that's fine because you like that. I'm totally okay with that because you lose like 5 seconds of progress if you die to that. Mm. And what it does is it teaches you like, oh crap, I can't count on anything that I relied on before.
Right.
Like all the power-ups were my friends before. Mm-hmm. This little mushroom guy, he is not my friend. I have to avoid this one.
I think the win stages cross the line for me. And I can't forgive them.
Ray actually linked to a comment on Reddit when in the notes. I said, this game never came to the U.S. or at least not until many years later in a different form because it was supposedly deemed too difficult, but citation needed. And Ray, being awesome, cited – I say it how you should, citation. And that was a Reddit Ask Me Anything with Howard Phillips who played a role in, you know, giving – like saying, hey, this game – he advised basically like this is a good U.S. release. This is not.
He's like the key source on all this stuff because nobody else is talking. I guess he did not sign an NDA, which is pretty – yeah. No,
I just think nobody else would remember as well as he would.
Right. I mean he was kind of like a kid who was like super excited to be playing all Nintendo games and offering a insight. Yeah.
This was
not
above
a kid,
Howard Lincoln's,
but a young man.
It was above Howard Lincoln's pay grade to know this.
He was also like assembling arcade cabinets and doing everything.
Yeah. He had like the dream job in 1986. Mm-hmm. So
until it turned into a nightmare and then he went to LucasArts, but he's a nice guy. He seems like a nice old man.
I mean, he wears like a bow tie. I trust anyone who
he dresses like vacation dad all the time. I actually saw him do a great presentation at the Classic Gaming Expo in 2012. I went there for 1UP, I believe, and he said something which I feel is a highly dubious claim in that he finished every NES game up to a certain point in time, and I'm like, every game? I don't know. Maybe he's that good.
Look, if your grandpa says he had to walk through the snow 10 miles to go to school, you're not going to question grandpa.
Those are his version of war stories.
I cut him a little slack there. I found another quote of him saying that like he thinks Miyamoto was maybe just depressed during the making of this game.
Yeah, so the AMA goes into it. He was – Jeremy.
What's that?
I was waiting for you to continue.
Oh, I don't remember what I was saying because everyone else talked and I've lost track.
Talk about the Reddit in which he it was found that he actually did think it was too hard or something?
Someone said it was too hard. Like the wind specifically. Mm. Actually, no, that was a comment that someone made. Like it seems very arbitrary, but it's not. There's like set points in the stage at which the wind will change direction.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, it is manageable. Like everything in this game – if you take the time to figure it out and understand how it works, it is manageable. It's just a game that throws a lot of stuff at you that shouldn't work, like, you know, squid flying through the sky and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I never played the Famicom version. Does the Famicom version give you any sort of indication, visual or audio, in terms of the fact that there's wind, or is it just there?
It's pretty much just there.
Yeah.
The lost levels, I believe there's like leaves that fly by.
Oh, no, so there's leaves. I'm sorry.
Oh, there's still leaves.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm sorry. I was thinking audio only.
I was curious.
Yeah, it definitely has the leaves.
At least they give you that.
Yeah.
So. I didn't get far enough to get to the wind. I played the NES, well, I guess Famicom Mario 2 when they put it out on the Wii, but I didn't get to the wind. I didn't play long enough to get to the wind. I was like, fuck this, after like two stages.
I remember that when Nintendo Power was covering Super Mario All-Stars, the contest was finish level D of this game and take a picture of the screen. Like, that is the challenge, mm-hmm. There was a big prize for that.
Yeah,
so according to Howard Phillips, 40 days ago, this was recent, huh?
Yeah.
Mario 2 was deemed too hard for American audiences. I believe so. Ultimately, Mr. Arakawa and I decided, but I lobbied hard that the game had some sucky bits in it. Unpredictable and so unavoidable kills like the wind gusts on jumps is not good design, in my humble opinion.
I'll tell you
so
what they
did. That.
One thing they improved in this game is the Princess Peach sprite. It is much better.
She looks like a human.
And yet, that's not the one that Nintendo keeps going back to when they make retro references. They always go to like the horrifying, misshapen Super Mario Brothers 1 sprite.
I will say it's still not good, but it's not like, what am I looking at? Some kind of cubist nightmare that the first Peach is.
So I'm sure the difficulty did factor into the decision not to bring this game over, but I also think the timing just didn't make sense. You know, the NES, this game launched in Japan in June 1986. That was right around the time the NES really went national in the US. And so, you know, over the next year and a half or so, that was the NES kind of trickling into homes and people were still just picking up Super Mario Brothers for the first time. So why bring over this sequel when people are still buying the first game? It ended up being one of the greatest, you know, best-selling games of all time. So, you know, once the NES had gained traction, say the end of 1987, 88. I think we talked about this on the Mario 2 episode.
Yeah.
Like Super Mario Brothers 2 Lost Levels was not that impressive looking, and I think Nintendo wanted to put its best foot forward, so it brought over a better looking and, you know, more fair, more congenial game.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like this one just lost out to the slow localization of the NES into America.
Yeah, it would have just been redundant on the shelves too. I would bet, you know, that I wouldn't be surprised if that also informed Arakawa's choice for Nintendo of America not to bring it over.
Also, it was released for a peripheral that didn't exist in the US, which is kind of an impediment. And we did get disk system games starting in like late 87 with Metroid, Zelda. Like that was summer 87.
Yeah, so, but those games had a lot more put into them.
Yeah.
But you know, Super Mario Brothers 2 is essentially an expansion pack, and that was for, you know, discs were much cheaper than carts. So if they had sold this in America for like, you know, whatever, $40, $50,
bucks.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Probably wouldn't have been exactly the same kind of sensation that the Mario USA would have been.
But Ray, why are you a fan of this game? What is it about it that
you
like
crazy?
So much? Be nice.
That's fair. No, I'm just mostly confused at why people just sort of go to default that it's bad. You know, the sort of narrative that actually it's bad. But I think people just don't understand the couple of contexts that were surrounding it. I think the first thing is a historical context, mm-hmm. which is, you know, as we already mentioned sort of already, that, you know, arcade games were sort of changing how video games were thought of in Japan at least, and especially in 83, 84, in the middle of the Famicom boom. So you had games coming out in the arcades like Tower of Jiraga and Pac-Land, which had a little bit more depth to them, a little bit more length. And Dragas especially had, you know, lots of tricks and secrets to it.
Yeah, that was a social experience right
so,
there.
Yeah, as you had these arcade games slowly evolving, that sort of starts to dovetail into the home market, and you have the home developers realizing that, oh, we don't have to just make arcade ports. We don't have to just make these games that are sort of just like escalating repetition, basically. We can add some stuff to it. But then they also took the lesson that, you know, there should be some secrets and trickery to it. And then Nintendo releases the first Super Mario Brothers, and that's like a flashpoint of not just how people are releasing and designing the games after that, but also this flashpoint of you have all these players in this entire country trading mysteries with each other. And so I think after that, you start to see the progression of Mario clones and so on and so forth, and a lot of games that basically have mystery in their title coming out for Famicom. Mystery of Atlantis and like Super Xevious, the Mystery of Gamp or whatever. And these games with lots
Mystery of Murasame Joe.
Yeah, Mylon Secret Castle.
Yep.
Things like with a lot of literally hidden stuff in it that you'd probably have to buy the strategy guide for. So then we have Super Mario Brothers 2 coming out at what I pretty much think is the zenith of this trend in the Famicom world. Where you have a game that is built upon more secrets and trickery, and like Jeremy said, it is the secondary title of it is Super Mario Brothers for Super Players. So you have Nintendo making this game essentially as a gift for all these kids who have obsessed over Mario 1 for like the past year, basically, and just giving them more to it, and also giving a gift, I guess, to the book publishers to have more source material to make things for.
And also it was, a good sales pitch for the disc system. Like, hey, there's this peripheral, and yeah, you can play Zelda, which you've never heard of before.
Yeah, there's a new Mario game.
There's a new Mario game. It's totally new. It's not just the same game.
It's a system seller, yeah.
I feel like, no, I agree with Ray in that we were not given this game the proper context to appreciate its design philosophy. And I think this really shows just how much context will inform the evaluation of a game, like both like the cultural experience surrounding it and the history behind it and everything like that. Yeah. I feel like it just shows you can't evaluate a game in a vacuum. So many things affect the evaluation of a game.
I completely disagree. You should only objectively review games and just be blindfolded to everything else about it.
That's one way to feel.
Listen, yeah.
No, I kid. I'm joking.
We all know Henry's kidding.
Okay, it's okay, Henry.
we're all wounded in this room.
Yeah, exactly.
For being in the game's press.
Exactly. For not being expert enough. that's my first point, though. My second point is just regarding the game itself, in that I think people complain too much about elements of Super Mario Bros. 2 that have now been used or seen or referenced in Mario games in the 30 years since. We have, you know, even in Mario 3, there's very difficult levels, World 7, World 8. In Super Mario World, there's the Star Road and the special stages, which are this, you know, this briefcase full of levels that are like, you know, just extra challenges for you. And in fact, one of them spells out in coins, you are a super player. So it's, you know, it's calling back to Super Mario Bros. 2. Then we have, you know, the Mario Sunshine block levels and Super Mario Galaxy 2, which again is a whole game full of challenging levels that builds upon the first game, which may not be as challenging.
Right.
And then after that, also, you know, Mario Odyssey and so on and so forth, up to Mario Maker, which is again headed by Tezuka, much like Super Mario Bros. 2 was. And it's just like now the guy who probably has the most intuitive knowledge of how to make a Mario level is letting you make them. And guess what? All you're doing is making a bunch of hard-ass levels.
That's true.
For you and your hardcore buddies.
That's not what their dream was with Mario Maker, but it's just how it turned out.
Yeah, I mean, with Mario Maker, unless you were given levels that were curated, it was either something a child made in like 3 minutes or a level designed to like just shove bamboo under your fingernails. Yeah.
So it's like it's this duality of, well, you know, I like having a good Mario game with lots of challenging levels, but not if it's too mean, like Super Mario Bros. A lot of levels. I mean,
one sort of point to balance that out is that the games you cited, almost all of them build up to that level of challenge, whereas Super Mario Bros. 2 Lost Levels is balls hard from the very start. Like you kick off the game and you're like, wow, I just got shredded. What the hell? Whereas the other games, you know, you're talking about like World 7 and 8 of Super Mario Brothers 3 or the Star Road of Super Mario World. Like you build up to that. This game is just like, you know, it's full throttle from the start.
It reminds me, too, of like Super Meat Boy. If you started just with the Dark World and Super Meat Boy, like that was World 1 of it. It's I can't – it's tough for me when looking back on Mario to like I can't separate my feelings from it at the time I experienced it, which was the All-Stars version. And when I played that, I was like – I don't like this. This makes me unhappy playing it. And maybe it too was – it. I think maybe a thing that hurt it in my subjective viewing of it at the time was I was playing three other games that I was feeling immense nostalgia for already as like a 10-year-old, or 12-year-old, which is weird to think nostalgia for
I felt
something.
The same way.
But then I'm playing that and I'm like, well, I love this because I always love this. And then I'm playing Lost Levels. I'm like – this is not familiar and it's hard. This is the worst. Like that was probably what's as darkened my memories of that from the beginning.
Well, I was delighted with it from the beginning because it's like, well, first of all, I always wanted to see what Mario 2 was, the other Mario 2, and just like, well, you know, as I'm playing it, it's like, well, I've seen everything that the first game can do, but here's something that is basically like expanding my mind of what we can do with the level design of this. So, I enjoyed it quite a bit that way. I think also like – there is a progression to it, to what Jeremy said. I just think that the base level is a bit higher than some of the other games. That's valid as well.
Honestly, I really feel that if this game took a few worlds to sort of build up to crush you and destroy your self-esteem and happiness, people would feel a lot more kindly disposed to it. But because it's just like you suck at the very – like from the very start, like it's just gloves off, I think – people bounce off of it really quickly, and
I think there is a escalation. It doesn't just plateau from the first world.
No, but it starts out. Like, it doesn't take long to
true.
Just be like, wow. What?
I think I can at least beat the first world, and then I just give up.
Yeah, I mean, it does some really cruel things. Like I wrote it down in the notes for the last episode and didn't bring them over, but you know, there is one stage that has multiple warp zones in it. And none of them are good warp zones. All of them are bad. Like they will take you back to the beginning of the game. And there's like if you get into them. Okay, so one of them is midway through a stage. And you think, oh, it's just going to be like a normal coin room. But then it is actually a warp zone back to the beginning of the game. So if you know about that, then you're like, okay, I can't go down into what seems like a normal coin room because it's not. It's a trap. And then you go to the end of the stage and – you're like, oh, wait, this is really interesting. This flagpole here is actually really close to the final to the final staircase. I could jump over it. What would happen? Well, what happens is you go to another warp room that takes you back to the beginning of the stage or the beginning of the game. So
I love
like,
that one.
Every time you try to use these tricks that you learn in the first game, it's like – bad and it slaps you on the wrist.
I love that reverse warp zone in its cruelty because it also gives you a choice of like, well, you don't have to go down this.
You can
also
just
kill
die.
Yourself.
There's a
just
hole
kill
here.
Yourself right now and start over this
stage. What a great lesson.
Yeah. I mean, it's I'm actually not – I don't know. I've come around on this game and I sort of respect what it does. But I have to admit that what it does is really, really – like sometimes it is just – you think, okay, well, I've avoided one trap, so now I'm safe. But no, you're not. You got complacent, and now that was your mistake. You screwed up.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's all about subverting your expectations. And I think, again, we go back to it was made for a software climate that was designed to challenge these hardcore kids who had basically seen it all up to that point and just wanted something more.
So I would say that the game that maybe – best embodies the spirit of the Lost Levels in kind of like taking your familiarity with a classic game that you love and flipping it on its ear and does it better is Mega Man 9. Like Mega Man 9, that whole game is designed around like, hey, all these comfortable play patterns you got into with Mega Man 2 and 3. No, you can't do that anymore.
You are right. I do think Mega Man 9 is
a bad idea.
I do think that game is way too hard.
Oh, I love it though. Like
I do like it.
Because I guess, you know, because I have so much love for Mega Man 2, like going into a game that's just like, oh, you know Mega Man 2, huh? Well, that's your problem. You should not be such a fan of Mega Man 2 because it's going to be your doom.
I forgot. You're not allowed to say you think a game is too hard on a podcast.
But no, I think
those are weakness.
It gets really hard at the end. Absolutely.
I couldn't beat the Wily stages.
But there are some really clever moments in that game where I'm just like, oh, you got me, you assholes. You knew what I was going to do there and you got me. And that's what this game does. And I think playing Mega Man 9 helped me come around on this and be like, okay, I get what they're doing. Yeah. I still don't like it all that much. I don't think it's that fun for me personally, but
wow, I didn't know
I don't think – what's that?
Shocking revelations.
That I don't think Super Mario Brothers 2
Oh, I thought you were about Mega Man 9.
Oh, no, no. Okay. I think Mega Man 9 is amazing. I love
okay,
it.
Okay, I thought I was going crazy
No, no,
over
no.
Here.
I'm saying Super Mario Lost Levels. I don't really personally enjoy it that much, but I do think it is a good and interesting and clever game.
I think they reacted strongly to this too on development side of like, oh, these they then made – Mario 3 is so much more inviting than even the first Super Mario Brothers. Yeah. Like it seems they definitely declawed themselves a lot after this game.
Well, again, I mean, I think also I would say, despite everything I said, I think putting a 2 on the title was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because they should have just called it Super Mario Brothers for Super Players and treated it more as an expansion pack essentially and just made it like this cheap disc that you can get with more Mario levels. Mm-hmm. I think putting a 2 on it just kind of twisted things in the future as we in America would learn about it and be like, oh, there's another Mario 2. Oh, but they thought it was too hard. Oh, but and so on and so forth. So I think maybe that's also a key thing behind sort of the narrative that's cropped up in recent years. I don't think Miyamoto was depressed because Miyamoto wasn't really involved with it.
Yeah, that's a weird narrative. And
quoting Howard Phillips, guys.
Did he say that?
That was a quote of Howard Phillips I saw on the internet.
I'm sure he was joking, but people were like, oh, Howard would know. Yeah.
Yeah, he was depressed. Tight. He and Miyamoto were best buds.
Yeah. I think part of this game also just got ET'd, like in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's fair enough. He got really.
Here, I'll read the whole quote here. This is an interview he did. Right when the game came out on the Virtual Console in 2007. Classically un-Miyamoto in that it's random and out of the player's controls. Maybe Miyamoto was depressed at the time he made Mario 2, end quote.
No.
I felt like that could have been said in jest.
Yes,
and we're not getting the intonation there.
Yeah, it probably just came through text, but... That's – hey, I'm believing in a Destructoid headline from 2007.
Okay? Why not?
I'd be careful there. either way, it's inaccurate.
All right, so what haven't we talked about with Super Mario Brothers 2, The Lost Levels? We haven't talked about the bonus stages at the end of the game where there's a whole lot of extra levels. The game is 32 levels long, 32 grueling, punishingly cruel levels, and then there's a whole bunch of bonus levels that are actually much crueler. And I am not going to lie. I have not played those levels because I am not good enough. I am not a super player. So, Ray, can you walk us through what all that post-game stuff is about?
Yes, sort of. Well, I've only genuinely played through them all at least once in earnest.
That's once more than I have.
Yeah, and it was some years ago. But yeah, there's a secret World 9 and then a secret World A, then B, then C, then D.
Each of those have 4 stages apiece?
Yes.
So that's 20 extra stages.
And do you access those just by finishing the game?
You finish the game 8 times in a row.
Oh, cool.
Originally on the disc system and then you can access those. Those are tallied by the stars on the title screen.
Okay, wait. You don't have to beat it like 8 times in one sitting though, right? It's a cumulative thing that saves on the disc system.
Oh, God. Now you're really challenging me. I don't remember.
That's got to be. Like, I can't imagine.
It can't be that mean.
32 stages 8 times through.
I'm buying this depression theory now.
No, it's got to be one of those like – each time you beat the game, you like, you know, it gives you an extra star on the
save
screen.
The one thing is that if you do use forward warps, it's okay. So if you do warp at some –
There's forward warps, not just backward ones?
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, they grant you that. but yeah, I don't know what to say really about the levels content themselves. It's just that's more of the same sort of punishment and
just
some of
trickier.
They do start breaking more rules in terms of like, you know, putting Bowser out in the daytime just in the middle of a thing. And
yeah. Sure, of course. So it really does turn into Mario Maker.
Yeah. But, okay. Yeah, for sure. And that's exactly what I'm talking about when people are like,
but you have to
complain.
You have to beat these levels, all the way through on a single playthrough, right? Like you don't get to continue?
Without warping to really genuinely get through them all.
Wow.
So not just in these levels but in this game as a whole, do they put any extra spice on the Bowser fights? I wasn't sure about that.
No, I think I think Bowser's limited to just throwing more hammers.
Okay.
But
and there's like a blue Bowser and a green Bowser that some people are convinced are different characters or something.
Oh, sure.
That was like a weird rabbit hole that I discovered while researching for this.
Yeah, I'll just read the wiki on that. Thanks.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, it's different colors.
The Foreman Spike of Bowser.
Yeah, exactly.
Bowser's Foreman.
He works for him. They work together.
So not just in the post-game stages, but are there any levels that particularly stand out to you that you think, oh, yeah, this one was really great or this one was really clever? Like things that you really stuck with you and made you love the game.
I mean, I did mention the sort of Bowser in the middle of the daytime stage before. I mean, that's kind of a really – that's one that jumps out at you sort of. I don't think any of the later ones really stuck out to me. I just sort of like some of the main game levels, the ones that like if you go too forward, if you scroll the screen too forward – you basically screwed because you can't jump up to a rear invisible block and get.
I've done that one too.
Yeah, just classic ones like that.
That happens right around the same time as the backward warp stages. So, I feel like that's where the game really takes off its glove and is like, you're actually not getting any further than this.
If I can remember, like some of the characteristics of 9 through D are just kind of a little bit less puzzly and just more like endurance challenges, basically.
You know, another thing that I didn't like about it was I was just looking this up to confirm it. Was like, yeah, they reuse enemies in different ways, like the bloopers outside of water. But there's no new enemies in it. Like they didn't make even just one new enemy sprite in it. It's just lazy is not the right word.
They're working too hard on that Princess Peach makeover.
Yeah, exactly. But they couldn't. It again just felt more expansion packy of just like, well, we have these assets and we're going to remix them in this way instead of developing a new enemy for that world. Even just one. Just one.
They put smiley faces on different things too.
I mean, they queued it up.
Everything is happier, which is weird.
That is
because
funny. Yeah.
The player's not happier, so it's like there's a certain level of sadism baked into the universe here.
Yeah, I guess my argument to that would be just like, well, again, they are just like working with what they've already established and just giving people more of the same set of tools, but just sort of tweaking things in different ways.
Well, they did tweak all the background graphics.
Yeah, like,
there's more depth to the visuals.
A lot of the tile graphics are changed and improved. And of course, there's the red piranha plants. That's technically a new enemy.
So
I stand corrected.
Yeah,
they're the ones who don't hide in their pipes if you're close to the pipes.
Yeah,
yeah, I thought so.
They'll walk off the edge of a pipe when they come to.
Well, and Ouija does play a little differently in this one.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we didn't talk about Ouija.
Yeah. I mean, it's not two player, so it's a singular challenge for a single super player who wants to either try traditional Mario physics or Luigi's special brand of physics. They're a little bit more slidey. Speaking of ice physics.
Yeah, so what is different about Luigi here? He jumps a little higher. He's a little floatier.
Yeah, and a little bit slidier. So, yeah. Basically, looser. He's a bit loosey-goosey.
Kind of similar to how he plays in USA then, I guess.
Similar, yeah. I mean, in as much as the fact that, we want to establish Luigi as a different character. With
Light in the loafers, as they
know. Is that true?
I don't know about that.
Howard Phillips, everybody. He said it.
okay, we mentioned that this did not come to the U.S. on NES.
It didn't?
But it did come to America in the form of Super Mario Brothers All-Stars, which, of course, does make some changes not just to the visuals but to the physics of how the games work.
Yeah.
But it kept all like the bonus stages and everything, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then it also came in a more unexpurgated form on Game Boy Color in Super Mario Brothers Deluxe.
Forgot about that. Mm-hmm.
And you can't play that right from the beginning. You have to unlock it by getting a certain score, like 240,000 or something in Super Mario Brothers.
That's the right way to do it, I think. Like that presentationally, I think that's the best way of handling it, because then you know a person has finished Super Mario Brothers to the extent that they've earned their badge of like, okay, you're certified as this good enough of a player. Here's the new stuff.
This is for super duper ultra players because of how zoomed in the screen is.
One of my recurring complaints on Game Boy Works is when Game Boy games try to use NES graphics directly, and you lose a lot of exterior screen information and things become much harder.
I played through the whole thing.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Well, Mario Deluxe was important to me to begin with, but yeah.
In what sense?
I just, you know, it was a purely nostalgic thing of just like having a key game to me at the beginning, the original Super Mario Brothers, and just like having that in a portable form was like super duper novel to me. And I just...
And now with a world map.
And
Red Coins.
The Super Players levels are a bit of a letdown just because they didn't use the new graphics. That was the biggest letdown to me, is that they just couldn't, I guess, find extra space to add the change to graphics.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so it's the same
original
old
Super Mario Bros. 1 graphics.
Yeah.
Huh.
And no extra bells or whistles in that way.
Interesting. But they did add red coins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do the Lost levels or the Mario 2J levels have red coins in them too?
I don't remember.
Because that would be hell.
Okay, you got me. I don't know the answer on that one.
Boy,
I didn't think about that.
I
remember red coins, and I don't remember where I remember the red coins from.
They're not necessary, but having a zoomed in screen and that extra red coin objective would make this like the ultimate exercise in Mario expertise, like in someone playing this and getting through it.
I remember collecting all the red coins. I just remember if they were all in the Lost levels.
Right. Sorry about that, folks. We're lame.
Well, we can always edit it out.
Yeah.
Try it.
So we didn't get Super Mario Brothers: The Lost Levels in America on NES, but we did kind of get little bits and pieces of it in the arcade. For those who happened to come across Versus Super Mario Brothers in the arcades back in 1986-87, may not have realized it, but they were playing little bits and pieces of Mario 2. So Super Mario Brothers, or Versus Super Mario Brothers, came out as part of the Versus series that Nintendo created for, like, you know, arcade counterparts with some upgrades to its Famicom and NES games. And in the case of Versus Super Mario Brothers, instead of adding new mechanics and that sort of thing, what they did was they tweaked the arrangement of the NES game. So they took out some of the easier stages and push some of the harder stages forward in the game. So, you know, games stages like Worlds 2-2 and 2-3 are basically repeated later in the game, 7-2 and 7-3, but with more enemies, more challenges. So what they did was they took out a bunch of those early stages that were kind of toothless and easy, and they pushed the harder versions of them forward. And then in those slots where you suddenly had level spaces freed up, they took some stages from Super Mario Bros. 2, which was available in Japan around the same time, and mixed those in. So Versus Super Mario Bros. Is this kind of weird, not a remix. I guess it's a remix, but it's not like a
remix.
it's not like a half and half game. It's mostly Super Mario Brothers, but there are these stages from the other game in there. So it's a really interesting kind of halfway rendition of the game.
That, well, because they got to get more quarters out of you.
Right.
Like the, if they take it too easy on you, you're playing too long without the quarters. I did play this one because my local Applebee's had it. And so and then we'd go out for a family dinner at old Applebee's. I played it a couple times and was just in shock of like, well, wait, the thing I always do in 1-1 isn't here.
Right.
Where what's it? It felt like a finger was missing or something.
Yeah, well, I thought that was a me problem. Mm-hmm. I was like, this game is way harder than the Mario I've played at my friend's house. And like he showed me all these tricks and none of them seem to work and I don't understand. But yeah, it takes out a lot of the invisible mushrooms. It takes out all the – or the one-up mushrooms. It takes out a lot of the power-ups. It takes out the ability to do the minus world. It takes out the ability to do the infinite lives trick with the turtle in 3-1. Like it just changes a lot of things to make it harder. The countdown has been shortened in most stages. It's just like, you know, the arcade version of Super Mario Brothers. Super Mario Brothers was a game created for home consoles. So it does go kind of easy on players. It's challenging, but it's manageable. Whereas, you know, arcade games around the same time, stuff like Ghosts and Goblins, where it was just like, okay, you've had your 3 minutes, now give us another quarter. And that's the philosophy that they infused into versus Super Mario Brothers.
I played a bit of this at my local arcade growing up, and it did feel weird. I think I really ultimately could not get over playing this game with a joystick because of how comfortable it felt to
especially
just hold in B.
The stubby Nintendo joysticks that they had on their cabinets.
But yeah, I would notice a lot of things like, oh, instead of the tinier tweaks were like, instead of a Koopa here, instead of a Goomba here, it's a Koopa. Instead of a Koopa, it's a Buzzy Beetle. They would just like put the harder enemies in instead of the easier ones.
Yeah, it's kind of like the second playthrough of Super Mario Brothers after you beat the you know Bowser and 8-4 the first time. You can play it again and like Buzzy Beetles have replaced Goombas and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's a little, it feels a little bit like that. It's not quite that extreme, but
I had no idea though that they added in 2J levels to this game because I only played like the first 3 levels of versus Super Mario Brothers and I assumed
right.
it was all just like swapped around enemies.
No, there are some substantial changes and additions, and everyone can play it for themselves very easily now because the game is on Switch Arcade Archives thanks to Hamster.
And it is one of the top-selling eShop games, but I don't think people really know what it is.
Yeah.
What
have I gotten myself into? Yeah.
I think that's really smart of Nintendo that they know – well, maybe they just stumbled into this, but they can rest assured that when Super Mario Brothers – for real comes to the Switch, that will sell quite a lot. So why not give people a weird-ass version of it first to then sell all of those copies, sell a shitload of those for people who are jonesing for Mario.
Yeah. And I am not going to commit myself to this game fully until Hori's Ersatz Joy-Con, Left Joy-Con comes out where I can play with a proper D-pad. I feel like that's the way God intended for me to really play versus Super Mario Brothers. And until that can happen, I mean, there is, you know, the Pro Controller, but I want to play it in a handheld format.
Yeah. I bought this one over the holiday break because I had brought the Switch to my mom's place to show it off. We ended up just playing Jackbox Party Pack the most. But,
right.
But when we wanted to play an old game, I was like, well, we could play sort of Super Mario because it brought us – Super Mario especially has a real special place in my heart with my mom because – you know, I begged and begged and begged for an NES, and I got it. But when we got it, she played Super Mario Brothers at least as much as I did, if not more, because she didn't have bedtime. She could stay up and play it all night. And, like, so it was fun to play, you know, 33 years later, Jesus, playing Super Mario with my mom again, even if it was Versus was all I could download. But one last thing I'll say about it is that I only played it a tiny bit at Applebee's as a kid because then once I realized the tricks to it, I was like, well, I'll just go over to the PlayChoice stand and play RBI or something else like for 3 innings and then I need to beg for another quarter.
I wanted to add something, a couple things. Mm-hmm. First of all, you mentioned that they shortened the countdown sometimes. That reminded me of Super Luigi U, new Super Luigi U, which is another game made just with challenging levels. So there you go. There's another example.
Yeah.
And also just on the general subject of like tweaking levels, like it reminded me also in Mario Deluxe, the super player levels are kind of – they took out the wind and they shortened some bits of it to make some jumps easier in other levels. So – It's a bit of a neutering.
That might be the only sense in which this game is a neutering.
I don't know. But yeah. There you go.
We didn't get Mario 2 in America. We did get versus Super Mario Brothers, but we didn't get another game, which was Super Mario Brothers Special. But then again, I don't think most people played this one. This was another one of those Hudson games. It came out around the same time as Mario 2 for Famicom Disk System. This game came out for PC-8801 again, and I think Sharp X1. And yeah, it's one of those Hudson joints where you're like, oh, it's the Nintendo game, but everything's off and weird. And I discovered this game thanks to Ray, actually, back at 1UP. And so I think I will let you talk about
again.
This one.
Yeah.
When I think of like oddball, esoteric Hudson games that are very interesting and a little confusing, I think of you. I feel like that's something you have a fondness for, or at least a lot of knowledge of.
Well, thank you. I guess I'll say, you know how Super Mario Brothers is known for its horizontal scrolling? Super Mario Brothers Special has none of that. It is as a screen flipper, basically. You go to the edge of the screen and there's the rest of the level.
And this was not unheard of. There were a few other games that had this effect, you know, this terrible handicap thrust upon them, such as Adventure Island for Sega SG-1000.
Yeah.
Like that. Wow, that's a rough one.
So, I mean, this was a common problem, I think, not just these computers, but also computers over here, the IBM PC standards, which basically had to have scrolling completely hacked in like years after these platforms were invented. So, I mean, it's, again, just Hudson trying to work within limitations but also deliver a Mario game with like completely new levels. Some of them might be as punishing as some of the lost levels, not just entirely because of the lack of scrolling, but just like they're kind of like trying to puzzle things out. And it's also made by people who are not at Nintendo, so they don't really know.
I don't know what colors they had access to, but they chose the worst ones because this hurts to look at this game.
Yellow, it's like Mario's Adventure in Orange Land?
Yeah.
That's basically it.
Ice for I guess, people that want to go blind.
They probably had access to like 6 or 8 colors.
Yeah.
I'm sure they did their best. The game looks pretty – I mean, colors aside, it looks pretty much like Nintendo's visual design.
Mm-hmm.
But the – not having played it myself but just looking at it, the physics seem off. Like the way turtles fall, like it's a weird arc that isn't like Super Mario Brothers. It's like what are they doing? And the way Mario moves, like I – you know, watching YouTube videos of people trying to do the maneuver that Mario does where he jumps and – twists around in midair so he can like, you know, reach a platform that's directly above him. You just can't do that here.
Yeah.
So I feel like they did their best and it wasn't good enough. Okay. But they compensated by throwing in some stuff that wasn't in Super Mario Brothers. And the further you get into the game, the weirder things start to be. Because after a while it's like, it's Super Mario Brothers, but here's elements from Mario Brothers. And now here's some elements from Donkey Kong. So like the point at which you are in Bowser's castle and you need to go up the staircase and there's barrels falling down the staircase and a question block and you hit the question block and a hammer comes out, that's where you're like, all right, okay,
bring
sure.
Bring in the punch balls. I feel like that's heightened by the screen flipping, basically, because, you know, every time you reach into the screen blanks out for like a split second, and then you're presented with something else, and you had no idea if it was coming or not. I mean, if you're playing it first time, it's complete discovery just because of the screen changing.
Yeah, well, I do think they make the best of the screen flipping here, whereas Adventure Island on SG-1000, like I've played that, and they didn't really change the level layouts to accommodate for the fact that, hey, like you don't know what's coming up after you flip screens. Here, each screen becomes its own kind of like you know, microcosm.
Exactly.
And everything is self-contained. Like, there are no stages that no transition that I've seen in like the 20 minutes of video that I've watched where you do a screen transition and it, like, if you're not jumping, then you're going to bump into something, or if you are jumping, you're going to get screwed over. Like, it's always fair. When you transition into a new screen, you have a chance to respond and react.
It becomes unfair later in this game I'm looking at right now.
Oh, does it?
Where you jump off a platform into nothing, you don't know where you will end up.
Yeah. So in some cases, you know, they got even more cruel than Mario 2.
Well, so I watched the first half of the game, I guess, and it seemed okay. But
I feel like that could be just a late game sort of addition.
Yeah, I jumped ahead and skipped around toward the end and didn't watch every single transition. But
it's hard to watch. This game is hard to look at. So I don't blame you for only watching 20 minutes of it.
I did kind of blank out for a while after watching it for a bit.
I mean, everything is based on the fact that these computers were just like a generation or two removed from a calculator. So.
Right. I mean, it's impressive that they managed to, you know, squeeze this game into this tech. Like, it is an effort, an act of self-abuse and also a little bit of love.
It's a triumph in that way for Hudson that they even made a game that could be presentably confused with Super Mario Brothers in a screenshot.
God, I wonder how many kids they ruined with this game.
I don't think this,
away from video games.
I don't think this game is actually all that special, but it definitely is kind of Super Mario Brothers. But you know, the existence of these Hudson games, there's like three or four of them that they adapted from Nintendo games. Like, they're just strange that they existed. And Nintendo by this point, you know, this was 1986, so Nintendo was pretty much all in on Famicom, NES, and they weren't licensing stuff. But then Hudson was still making these games, so it makes me wonder, like, did Hudson have a special exception because they supported the Famicom really early on? Mm. And in a lot of ways, you know, Nintendo owed some of the success of the Famicom in the early days to the work of Hudson, games like Lode Runner and Nuts and Milk, I don't know.
Well, they also made the software for Family Basic. So that was the tightest they probably ever got.
Okay, right.
And
I forgot about that, yes.
Or so, it could be a business deal was made over drinks and one person didn't remember.
Sure, maybe,
Yeah, it was a more informal time. You hear stories of Yamauchi's capriciousness in making decisions sometimes. It could have just been a golfing buddy or whatever.
It's the bubble. Anything is possible.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, Nintendo was okay with this terrible butchery of Super Mario Brothers, but then a few years later when id came to them and were like, look, we put Super Mario Brothers 3 on a PC, let us make this game for you and publish it and you're going to be rich, it's going to be crazy, and Nintendo said no. Like, that does kind of speak to, you know, I think how the company clamped down by that point, because you started to see less and less American designed weird Mario paraphernalia merchandise at that point. But I also wonder how much of that is just about relationships, because Nintendo and Hudson were tight, whereas Nintendo probably saw id come to them and were like, who are these people? Like, we don't know them. We don't have a relationship.
Nobody's from Texas. Like, they made a game.
Japanese business is so heavily predicated on relationships and trust and getting to know people and you know, building that bond over time. So I could see where, you know, Hudson built that with them, whereas id did something that was, I think, in a lot of ways more impressive than what Hudson did here, and brought it to Nintendo and probably could have made Nintendo a lot of money on the PC market. But Nintendo was like, who are you, Texans? What's up?
Well, and for Nintendo, like, they do make a lot of money. So it is weird to think of somebody just leaving millions and millions of dollars on the table. But
that's
for them,
Nintendo's
it's
way.
Just like, we've got money. Or also maybe at the time they were thinking, well, we've got a deal going with Philips or whatever put this somewhere else. So you Texans are getting in the way of this shit.
Yeah, Nintendo is always happy to turn away monies as long as they do so on their own terms. So this was, id was them saying no on our terms. Like, this is going to be, you know, how we do things. Philips was them saying no to Sony and sticking with their own terms, even though it was, you know, the outcome was terrible there. Just awful. I mean, PlayStation's great, but the CDI games, not so much.
PlayStation doesn't have Hotel Mario, does it?
No, it doesn't. And we're going to have ourselves a Hotel Mario episode one of these days.
Mario checks in, but he doesn't check out.
Anyway, yeah, so
I like that.
Super Mario Brothers special, weird little game. Okay, just two more things to wrap up here. All Night Nippon Super Mario Brothers, which is one of those things that in my younger days I almost bought just because it's such a weird little novelty. But I think at this point I have more financial responsibilities and the game has gone up in price a lot. So it's not really something that I'm tempted by anymore. But this was basically an official Nintendo authorized ROM hack.
Pretty much, yeah, one of the originals, but also not exactly unique in a realm of like other promotional type games that were coming out.
Right, but what was unique about it is that it is Super Mario Brothers. Yes. Where things have been hacked to be like very, very time and place specific radio personalities. It's a strange game. They took Super Mario Brothers, put it on Disk System, which happened on its own. Like you could buy Super Mario Brothers on Disk System.
Mm-hmm.
But this version of it, I guess they were like, well, we've got some extra disk space and this is a cheap medium. So let's give this away as a prize and use it to promote this radio program on Fuji Radio. So Goombas and other enemies, piranha plants become like caricatures of radio personalities. Which actually is really interesting. Like, how did people even know what these radio personalities looked like? Because it is radio. You don't see them.
Well,
I don't know what Rick Dees looks like. I could not point out Casey Kasem in a police lineup.
Wait, what?
There are like eight people on the cover of the caricatures of eight people on the cover of this game. But I recommend everyone look up the cover. It's very hilarious because it has a blue, sort of like the Ox King version of Bowser, holding out a piranha plant to one of the women on the In the radio show, and it's Kotabe art. Is it Kotabe?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really worth looking at because it's just bizarre and hilarious. And they're driving in a car.
Right.
They're driving in a mushroom car.
Well, for like a crash course in Japanese pop culture and celebrity, like you have comedians who are famous mostly on TV, but they also go on All Night Nippon, which is a long-running sort of comedy radio show that runs late at night, of course, and they have rotating hosts. And so it's a very popular sort of in and out thing where all these comedians come by all the time. So I guess, you know, the most contemporary regulars on that show were featured in the game.
That makes sense.
So
okay.
People would know who they are just by looking at them on TV and magazines and such.
It's more Fuji TV as opposed to Fuji Radio.
Hmm. No, I just mean everything.
Instead of the mushroom.
Not just Fuji. Oh.
Yeah. Oh. I was going to say, instead of the mushroom retainers, it's the eight people they're caricaturing in this game. So they show up at the end of every level.
They look like Miis, actually. On this cover.
I'd say this game has more in common with Versus Super Mario Brothers because it has some of the changed graphics.
Yeah. So this was only given away as a prize for a contest. Is that correct? In extremely small numbers. Well, relatively small numbers. There are some games like the Capcom Rockman games, the gold Rockman games that were given away to six people who designed or eight people who designed the Robot Masters. It wasn't that rare. And I think, you know, like 10 years ago, you could buy it for $100, $120. Now it's a lot more. So it's not like ultra rare like where it was, you know, $2,000 a couple of like 10 years ago.
If it was gold plated, sure.
Sure.
Not like not
just gold plastic.
I plated, quote unquote.
Oh, okay. So anyway, it is a pretty unique and rare Mario oddity. I don't know. Would you say it's the rarest Mario game? Or do you think maybe some of the Hudson PC games would be
depends on what,
to find?
Yeah, maybe. It also depends on what you define as a Mario game. Would you include like the sweater tutorial software?
maybe not.
Yeah.
Mario teaches sweating.
Sweating?
Sweating.
There's also the
knitting sweatings.
There's the version of Yoshi's Cookies that sells an oven.
Oh, right. That's true. Yeah. That's probably the rarest.
What version is this? I've never heard of it.
Oh, it's like another tie-in thing, but it's like Yoshi's Cookie, but with like imagery for like an oven.
Oh, okay.
Something like that. Mm. Or something else.
Yeah, you had to like buy an oven in order to get this game.
That's so great.
Yeah, it is super scarce. Okay, so maybe not the rarest Mario game, but definitely up there. And it does have some unique content. Like Ray said, it remixes some of the levels. So it's not just like, you know, Super Mario Brothers with some slightly hacked graphics. It is changed. So if you're interested, you could, you know, download a ROM of it and try it out and be like, oh, some weird stuff here. Okay, well, that's great. I'm glad I didn't spend $200 on this. Mm-hmm. The end. So finally, to wrap this up, I want to talk about at Ray's request or suggestion, the final – would you say it's the final version of Super Mario Brothers, the final take on Super Mario Brothers besides like lost levels?
Oh, I see. Yeah, maybe.
And that is Game & Watch Super Mario Brothers, which is one of the very final Game & Watches. There weren't that many more.
I think Zelda was last.
Yeah, it's not the last one. They were making Game & Watches until 89, I think. Yeah. This was 1987, but there weren't a lot after this. And it is kind of an impressive technical showcase of what the Game & Watch could do. You tend to think of Game & Watch as being like a very simplistic, limited sort of single screen game. And they used with this game the Game & Watch technology to create a side-scrolling, you know, 2D platformer. It's very simplistic. Obviously, it doesn't have like Mario's amazing physics and fluidity and that sort of thing. But given that it was basically a calculator playing Super Mario Brothers, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. It's kind of a trip too, but it's basically just Mario weaving his way up and down through platforms. So it's less of a platformer, kind of maze-ish as well, because they grow in complexity, of course.
Right.
But eventually, in like later stages, like you'll just be like have Mario flying in midair around like barriers and things. So it gets kind of trippy. It's almost in some ways like the Lost Levels, in the ways it sort of like flips the script on itself sometimes.
Does it have enemies in it, or is it just platforming?
I don't remember any enemies.
No, I think it was just – I played a lot of it too when it was new, and it was – I think it was just platforming. I just remember the constant like tick, tick, tick sound of moving through it and just seeing new things appear, like just new platforms appear as you're moving forward, which are just lines. Like they're just different lines and thing. But yeah.
Just digital bars.
Just digital bars. But to think that, you know, technology that they had only used for single screen experiences for so long, even when they did Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., that's like, well, we're not doing more than one screen. Somehow they are able to put Mario's, like for the LCD to work too, Mario's character has to be everywhere on the screen for him to be illuminated forever wherever you put him.
Yeah.
That's just like a lot of real estate for a character to take up.
Yeah, I imagine they had to use a more advanced watch processor for this because the original idea behind Game & Watch was that a calculator chip could only produce X number of illuminate X number of positions. So however many pieces there are on a digital watch, like that's the number of different phases or stages that an early Game & Watch could have. And I'm pretty sure this goes way beyond the limits of those early systems.
Yeah.
So this is an example of, I think, you know, the technology growing in a very sort of tiny and almost insignificant way.
I mean, I wonder really because like I would really like to know how this particular one was made. Yeah, for sure, because I'm sure they must have used some real trickery to like squeeze in all these sorts of level layouts and stuff. And it's like almost a decade's worth of like experience making these Game & Watch games. So you had these guys, I don't know, who knows what they could have figured out by then. Yeah,
I have very specific memories tied to this because it was when my family moved for the first time, which is like you're always going to remember that for the first time your family moves or if your family ever does move. I was like 7. It was 89. I'm 7. We're moving from Arkansas to Atlanta. And this is before we had the Game Boy. Like there was no Game Boy yet. So I think it was because I was just so sad, or just to make me feel better. My parents got me this Game & Watch to play through the trip. And so it's what I remember playing the entire drive from Arkansas to Georgia, and just over and over again, like just the sound of it, the playing of it. And also as a little kid who didn't have a watch, just having a thing to tell me what time it was like, wow, look at this. And it was just like so sturdy and cool. I really like that about it.
I never played it, so I can't speak.
I haven't either. I played a lot of these Tiger games, but looking at a video of this, it seems like it's not as visually interesting, but it's way more ambitious in terms of conveying.
Very sophisticated,
In terms of conveying like space you're traveling through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. They reinterpreted it a few times. There is like a crystal version of it, like a special edition Game & Watch that's just like a transparent version of it. And then they made a watch version of it as well. That was the first sort of watch, Game & Watch thing that came out in America.
Yeah, I had the Zelda watch, which was very well done in terms of conveying a dungeon on like an LCD watch. It was
you
can
even fight a Gliok, right?
There are multiple bosses. I think there's at least two bosses.
But Aquamentus, that's it.
That was pretty cool.
My only other problem with it now, though, is because I did I dug it up and actually bought watch batteries and played it like a decade ago again. But it's that I really miss a D-pad on it. It does not have a D-pad. It is it's two buttons on one side, four on the other for the D-pad.
It's just getting you ready for Switch.
Yeah.
But they already had the D-pad on Game & Watch technology was definitely existed already.
That was where the D-pad came from.
Yeah, so it's just weird to me that they didn't have it.
It makes sense to me because Mario is not moving smoothly.
No, that's true.
You're just tapping directions.
You really
and
are just going like, oh, now I got to be up. Now I got to be down. Got to be over. Like,
yeah, you're not playing Mario Odyssey with a Switch D-pad or anything.
That's true.
Okay, so any final thoughts on these Mario oddities, these odds and ends of the series?
I mean, nostalgia definitely means a lot for me in these because I have way more positive memories for the Game & Watch Mario than I do for Mario 2, which just came – Lost Levels just came to me at the wrong time for me to like it perhaps. But I don't know. Ray's talking it up maybe has gotten me to – maybe I'll try it again whenever – it eventually comes out on the Switch when I'm sure they'll have Virtual Console figured out any day now.
Yeah, they're working on
that one.
Yeah, but maybe I'll finally give it its a real shot on the Switch in the future.
That's all I would ask for, really, because like I just – like I said, this thing's kind of getting ET'd, and I think that people are just relying on rumors and people on other people on forums saying it's bad or whatever. And it's just like just try it for yourself. I mean, it's a Mario game. It's not some crazy super table flipping thing. I mean, it is just – it's a Mario game at its core. It's platforming. It has Mario physics. Like, just try it. And whether you like it or not, I mean, that's fine. But you should just try it for yourself.
My standout is the original Mario Brothers. I can always slip back into it. I feel like it's in my opinion, I think it's the most playable game of that vintage. It's still very playable today. And again, just stare at that arcade art. I love that era of Nintendo's arcade art.
Yeah, you know what? If they ever make Cuphead for Switch, they should add Mario and Luigi in that style.
Nice. That'd be amazing. Yeah, and also I think it was the Metacom. Is that the name of the – okay, yeah. They make figures of all the off-model Nintendo characters. So they do have a great little model Mario and Luigi, and I recommend you buy those and stare at them.
Yeah, I missed out on those.
And so you turn them to any angle than the one there on the cover and you're like, this is freakish.
Yeah, I also really love Mario Brothers, and it's one of those games I mentioned on our recent Namco episode that anytime I come across Dig Dug in an arcade, I have to play it. And Mario Brothers is one of those also where I see it, and if it, you know, the arcade actually, this game actually works, I will drop a quarter in and play it.
People always have photos of their loved ones or their pets on their iPhone lock screen, but mine has been Mario Brothers for the past 3 years because those enemies are so happy and they're smiling and I love nobody. So Mario Brothers is my one true love.
All right. You love it more than your bird.
Well, that's true. Well, my bird's my wallpaper, so they share equal footing in my life.
Of course. My mistake.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and thanks, guys, for coming in. Retronauts, of course, is a podcast that comes out weekly and then some, and you can listen to it at retronauts.com, on iTunes and other such networks and on Podcast One. We are supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. That keeps the lights on for the show and for our lives. So your support is awesome, and we reward you for that support with early access 1 week ahead to each episode and a higher bitrate with no ads. And that is a great and amazing deal that you just can't pass up. But if you do pass it up, that's okay. We still like you. Listen to it for free. It's cool. There's no barrier to entry here. We just liked having an audience of people listening to us talk about old video games. Okay, that's enough for me. Guys, tell us about yourselves.
Well, hey, I'm HENEREYG on Twitter. Follow me there for all my saucy opinions, but also to hear about my own podcasting empire I share with Bob, Talking Simpsons, where we do every episode of The Simpsons in chronological order, deep into season 7 at the time of this recording. And but you get so many more things, including What a Cartoon, where we go through a different cartoon episode every week in a different series in the Talking Simpsons style. We dig into all of the references. We dig into the history. We explain it all in our fun, nerdy way. And if you love Futurama, we did the same for Futurama, but it's only on our Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons, along with a ton of other exclusives.
And probably by the time this goes live, Jeremy will be on a few episodes of Talking Futurama.
Hell yeah.
Maybe.
But yeah, that's I call this. So this sales pitch has won over one person, so I consider it successful. I consider this so I'm going to call this the combo meal for Patreon. If you get Retronauts on Patreon for $3 and Talking Simpsons for $5, it's the price of a burrito. And for sacrificing one burrito meal, you will have a month of too many podcasts, frankly. Mm-hmm. You'll be drowning in podcasts, and we'll be holding your heads underwater.
And you'll live longer.
Yes, and you'll live longer. But yes, please donate to all of us, even Ray. Can we Venmo you, Ray?
Yeah.
Cool. So we'll put that on the website. But yes, I've been Bob Mackey. Find me on Twitter as Bob Servo, and please listen to all the podcasts. Thank you.
Yeah. And star of the show, please.
Well, first of all, I need that burrito meal. My family is dying.
Felt it starve for one night, so yeah, we might live.
I'm on Twitter, RDBAAA. I also make video games as Bipedal Dog on Twitter as well. I made a game called Blast Rush, which is about as dickish as Mario Brothers The Lost Levels, which means it's much better and you should play it for sure. That's on iOS and Android and Amazon, blah, blah, blah. Very good.
And finally, I've been Jeremy Parrish. I mentioned that maybe before, but I didn't mention that you could find me on Twitter as GameSpite and at Retronauts.com and other places where I do stuff and write stuff. It's great. Yeah, that's it. So we'll be back in a week with another full episode, and probably this Friday with a micro. So look forward to those. See you later.